there's a whole lot of people quoting the Federalist Papers on the right these days, you know, Texas versus the feds and all of that. So I had a question that popped into my head. How many of us have actually ever read the actual Federalist Papers and studied them in any way, shape, or form? So what better time, what better place than to do that on Critical Thinking? Also, never incorporate your company in Delaware, says Elon Musk, after a judge there takes away nearly $57 billion worth of Tesla compensation. And there's some good news, though, because Ron DeSantis actually scores a major victory against Disney and the wonderful punditry of folks like Vivek Ramaswamy, Donald Trump, look more like freezing cold takes. We also have a video that perfectly sums up DEI from a basketball game. I'm Andrew Coppins, and this is Critical Thinking. That's right, folks. You know the drill by now. Follow me on social media. I'm at The Coppins Show on X and Facebook. You can find us on Instagram, although we're not really all that active over there. And by we, I mean me, myself, and I, and Pat working in the background. He's going to have some announcements about some things coming his way shortly, I believe. So stay tuned for that at The Pat Oney Show for all of those things. Do not forget to download. Do not forget to rate, review. Make sure you're subscribing or hitting that follow button on Apple Podcasts, which over 80% of this audience partakes in. So please partake in that. That being said, you can do all of those things. You can watch this show on X. Again, I am at The Coppins Show. You can also watch on our Rumble channel. That's rumble.com/critical thinking. Rumble.com/critical thinking. So before I get into kind of the news topics, because there are a few big news topics that we do need to talk to, I want to address something for the show first, because we're on the first day of February, so great day to kind of start something new and kind of manage where we go from here. But also, as I hinted up top, given Texas versus the feds and all of the quoting of various, you know, parts of the Federalist Papers, it kind of gave me an idea. A thought popped into my head. It's time to study the actual Federalist Papers. What is the actual text? What are the writers of this? John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and I'm forgetting the third member of this group, but there were three people who wrote as publicists in this, in the Federalist Papers. 85 different essays, 85 different things to talk about. And so each day we're going to do a study of one of the Federalist Papers. In fact, we might as well just go in order. And so later on in today's program, that's what we're going to do. But before diving in like that, because this is a deep dive Thursday, as most of you know, we also have to take a look at two very important stories from the business world affecting economic freedom, I would suggest, in some way, shape, or form. So how about we start with the one that has the most shocking revelation to it, if you will? And that's Elon Musk's fight against the state of Delaware and apparently their ability to strike down his compensation package. Now, there are some details that we have to get through before we get into kind of a breakdown of what really took place in this quote-unquote case or whatever you want to call it. But it was taken away, this compensation package, by a Delaware judge, okay, who totally, spoiler alert, does not have a political bias or ties to the Joseph Marionette Biden family at all. All of it just a total coincidence. But anyway, back in the way back machine of 2018, Musk was granted the right to be compensated as part of his package as CEO of Tesla, a incentive package, if you will, that amounted to 12% of the value of the company. Not a specific dollar amount, but a percentage of the value of the company if he hit very specific, some would say lofty, some would say financially lucrative for other people, namely the shareholders, financial metrics. And if he hit them, then he would be entitled to full stock options. That if every one of them that he would hit along the way of this compensation package would total to about 12%. Piece by piece by piece by piece, he could get 12% in stock options as part of his compensation package. Okay. Well, Tesla did that. And they did so well that he hit all of those metrics, entitling him to that full 12%. Now, in 2018, the value of the entire company was around $58-59 billion. So at that point in time, 12% of that was a pretty big drop in the bucket for somebody who's already wealthy enough, like Elon Musk is and was back then. Now the company is valued at nearly $1 trillion, making his compensation package upwards of potentially $56 billion, $57, depending on the day, the time, where the stock price hits, right? But allowing him to basically buy shares and of a stock option at like 23-something a share, okay? The company is now valued at almost $1 trillion. Now, that $56 billion is now $51 billion as it lost 2% of its market share on the markets after the news that a magisterial judge in Delaware, not New Hampshire, but Delaware, decided, yeah, nah, we're not doing that compensation package. Nope. Never mind the fact that there are all sorts of safeguards and people who wanted this deal. So how the hell did this happen? Well, there was one shareholder who held 9 total shares in the company back in 2018 who decided to sue the board, to sue Tesla, to sue Elon Musk about this compensation package. Wasn't good enough for the shareholder, like I said. And as of yesterday, no bueno on the stock options. Compensation package, no good. Yep, that's right. One single judge in the state of Delaware has decided it's totally legal and correctly done process of Tesla, its board, its compensation requirements, and everything else, right? Everything done above board, null and void. Because, well, she doesn't like it, and it's not something that's quote-unquote normal or whatever have you, right? Now, ironically, the judge in this case, her last name is McCormick, talked about in this 201-page decision, how the hell that is a thing for this type of a situation, I've got no idea. But she talked about a lack of independence from the board, where she might actually have a point because, well, you see, Elon Musk, his brother, and other highly associated individuals populate the majority of the 8-person board. They have significant ties to Elon Musk himself. So the independence of the board, very, very good question to bring up. Thing to look at for Judge McCormick. There's just one problem. As she talks about the failure of independence, she's failed to recognize or disclose her close personal relationships with the Bidens and their political allies in the state of Delaware. You might say, well, there's not a whole hell of a lot of people in the state of Delaware, and you might be right, but what are the odds that this judge happens to know Joe Hunter, their entire family really well, and her previous law firm happens to just be the law firm tied to the Biden family? What are the odds of that? I mean, pretty low if you were just doing it above board, right? Now, you might be saying, what are you talking about when it comes to this judge in her independence or lack thereof? Well, I bring to you and your attention this from X. It's from Kanakoa the Great. Judge Kathleen McCormick rescinded Elon Musk's 55 here. It's actually closer to 57. But we're splitting hairs. It could be 51. It could be 49 billion, just depending on where Tesla stock goes. But Elon Musk's $55 billion Tesla compensation package overturning the company's board and 80% of its shareholders. McCormick also ruled against at Elon Musk during his Twitter acquisition. Oh, did I forget to mention that? Did I forget to mention that she also was involved in that? What the hell? Huh? There's more than one magisterial judge, okay? There's more than one. But it continues saying, before becoming the head of the Delaware Chancery Court, McCormick worked at a Delaware law firm called Young Conaway. Okay, so what? Well, what if I told you that this firm and its employees have been major donors to President Joe Biden for decades? In 2016, Hunter Biden hosted a gubernatorial campaign event for Congressman John Carney with then Vice President Joe Biden as the guest speaker. This event took place at the law offices of Young Conaway in Wilmington, Delaware. Carney, again, the congressman, is a close friend of Joe Biden for the last four decades. Later, to become governor, and then magically nominated Kathleen McCormick, a partner at Young Conaway, to her position on the Delaware Chancery Court. I mean, who, what are the totally unrelated odds of all of that? It's not nepotism or political payback or no, influence peddling. Nah, they're totally above that. Oh, but what if I told you the following also? In a March 2018 email, Hunter Biden claimed to personally know every judge on the Delaware Chancery Court while threatening legal action against his Chinese business partners. Quote, I will bring the suit in the Chancery Court in Delaware, which, as you know, is my home state, and I am privileged to have worked with and know every judge on the Chancery Court. After Elon Musk purchased Twitter with the stated goal of restoring free speech, President Biden called for a federal investigation into Musk on the podium at the White House. And we continue because there's still one more piece to this puzzle. Following this, the Biden Department of Justice, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission initiated legal actions and investigations against Tesla, SpaceX, and X. This recent decision by Judge McCormick, who works with Biden's top donors and was nominated by Biden's close friend to override Tesla's board and the majority of its shareholders, is another clear example of the Biden administration and its allies weaponizing the American legal system against their political opponents. That's the claim made in this post thread, right? That's what's going on. Do I buy it? Do I buy this? Yes, this story matters. It is an important story because there are two pieces to this puzzle. We are seeing a massive deviation from the norms of what should take place when it comes to executive compensation review. Okay, that is for sure. It would be different if there was evidence of some sort of real collusion to enrich the CEO. Or is this due to performance of and very specific hurdles that must be cleared to achieve all of them? And were they expected, unexpected? Were they minimally? You have to take a look at all of these things. And what I can tell you is that some of the targets were pretty easy to reach, but that's not uncommon in executive compensation packages. Now, the amount, the 12%, whatever have you with the stock option situation, is a little uncommon, okay? That's fine. But were the checks and balances, which is the board makes a recommendation and the shareholders have an opportunity to up or down vote that compensation package in or out? 80% voted for it. In any other era, Kathleen McCormick would not have been the one on this case, period, point blank, due to previous entanglements with Elon Musk and other companies. also because of her political ties to a real politicalized enemy of Elon Musk. There's no question that Joe Biden's administration, the president of the United States, who is a close personal friend of Kathleen McCormick and the Conaway law firm that she came from, a partner no less, not like a junior associate or something like that, that got plucked into this chancery position. No. So she would be plucked or should have been removed from making this decision simply based on previous situations involving X. But I'm going to get into that in a second. There's not just that. This is also, as they pointed out, an absolute continuation of weaponizing the legal system against political enemies. And it has to stop. Impartiality is supposed to be a key of these types of positions, if you don't understand what these types of positions are about. She is not independent in any way, shape, or form. She is a wholly owned political hack in a position of magisterial power. She has the power to just do this. Now, when we take a look at some of these other things, as I mentioned, right, McCormick, the judge in Musk's case to try and get out of buying Twitter, now X, for the original price that he had proposed. And what did he say was his case for that? That Twitter, now X, was not being real about the actual user base. That it had inflated its numbers based off of bots and inactive accounts and this, that, and everything in between, thus attempting to get out of it. Her argument back then was that, well, Elon Musk, this is the ironic part of all of this, was the richest man in the world and should be held to the terms of the agreement with Twitter because he can, quote unquote, afford it. Today, though, now give back a quarter or thereabouts of your current estimated wealth. The wealth that I used, by the way, to judge you by in the previous case, just 2 years ago. Give it back. Oh, but we're going to hold you to $44 billion for Twitter Now X. Now, are there good arguments that can be made for the decision that was being made in this case? Yes, there are. Such as the entanglements between board members and Elon Musk. I think that is a very legitimate question to ask. Are they acting in the fiduciary duty of shareholders? That is what the board of directors, your HOA board, or whatever else, they have a duty to act in the interest of shareholders, or in the case of an HOA, the unit owners. That is the duty they have to hold. That's a question worth asking. But does that mean on its face, this is a disqualifying factor that these people happen to be the brother of Elon Musk and other people closely associated with him from his time at Harvard or elsewhere, right? The raising of the question of proper shareholder governance is important. But you also have to balance what shareholders want. One shareholder is going to override the overwhelming majority. Now, does majority rule? Of course not, necessarily. There's still the law. There's still other things. But that being said, 80% of shareholders were presented with this financial compensation package to be given as the current and future CEO. Oh, and by the way, did I mention that Elon Musk hasn't taken a single dime from Tesla? He hasn't exercised these stock options? Because that's what they are. He hasn't exercised them. He also didn't take a dime of actual monetary compensation for the last 6 years. And also, this is really important. I spoke about that 80%. One judge and one shareholder, one shareholder. They get to override the agency of the 80% of the shareholders now? It's one thing if something is being done that is patently, obviously illegal here, and the majority of shareholders had voted for that obviously and patently illegal situation. That's not what took place here at all. This was an approved compensation package that happens all the time for every shareholder meeting that exists for companies of this nature. Largely because that 80% saw these various hurdles that needed to be reached as good for their bottom line, just like Elon Musk's bottom line. Ask somebody if they owned Tesla for $23 and now it's almost $200, if that was a good investment and Elon Musk brought value to them as the CEO of that company. Well, he's also got SpaceX and X now, and he can't possibly have the bull dit. Yet here we are. Just one shareholder has the ability to wipe the rest of them off the face of the map, and their business interests can't be represented here. They're to the exclusion of them, to the inclusion of one. That's weird. That's not normal. None of this is good, and none of this is okay. Now, before we get any further, folks, I just want to remind you, if you need a little pick-me-up, if you need to start your day off right, how about starting it with coffee from a coffee company that cares about its product, and that's it. We always say on this program, I am so very famous for saying, don't do business with businesses that will insult you to your face. You can't possibly know what every business is, you know, and what their CEO or whomever, right, or what they corporately stand for. You can't know that all the time. But how about this? How about standing with a business that cares about its product and that's it? There's no politics, no message to be delivered other than we make really good coffee, so buy our stuff. Go to coffeebrandcoffee.com, enter the promo code CRITICALTHINKER at checkout for 10% off of your purchase today. I highly recommend the bourbon flavor. It is my absolute favorite from them. I've tried about 3 or 4 flavors so far. I absolutely love it. Now, if you're not a coffee drinker, they've got tea. They've got hot cocoa. Unfortunately, my system won't allow me to drink hot cocoa. That is a no bueno situation for me for some strange reason, but I digress. The point of the matter is this. Very simply, they make really good coffee for you to drink, and that's it. CoffeeBrandCoffee.com, promo code CRITICALTHINKER for 10% off of your purchase today. All right, now with that all being said, we've got another piece of the pie for business today. And that was the news that broke yesterday that, well, Disney's got no standing and no jurisdiction in their lawsuit against Ron DeSantis in the state of Florida. So federal judge slapped back the lawsuit from Disney against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on the grounds of a lack of standing, and that they also lacked jurisdiction for bringing a suit like this. So, quite literally, they weren't even talking about the ins and outs and the efficacy of this argument or that argument. Yeah, we're going to take a look at whether or not your lawsuit goes forward, because the first requirement for this is, do you have standing and do you have jurisdiction? Is this the right place to put this lawsuit? And do you even have standing? The answer to this was no for a federal judge. Literally just no. Now, Disney is going to appeal, of course, but without getting too into the weeds of the legalese of all of this, they're not appealing on anything other than flimsy claims of standing or jurisdiction because, well, it failed bigly the first time. What's going to change? What is the fundamental change that would come about on this? Not even dealing the merits of the case. Yeah, no, you don't have standing. You don't have jurisdiction here, so bye-bye. Now, failing bigly, speaking of that, was this, because how about our wonderful friend, Vivek Ramaswamy, who back as this was all going down in being sued, interesting to see Disney have the last laugh. That's how the game usually ends, because DeSantis' Reedy Creek board says Disney stripped its power.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Right? So DeSantis stripped the power. And Disney was going to have the last laugh. Ha ha! Oops! Turns out, they actually do have that power. It turns out that, yes... you don't have any standing. There's nothing for you to know. The government has the power to say, yeah, nah. Oh, and then there was our other fine friend whom Vivek loves to cover for, and that was a former president and current likely GOP re-nominee for president here in 2024. That's one Donald Trump, who had this to say back on April 18th of 2023. DeSantis is being absolutely destroyed by Disney. His original PR plan fizzled, so now he's going back with a new one in order to save face. Disney's next move will be the announcement that no more money will be invested in Florida because of the governor. In fact, they could even announce a slow withdrawal or sale of certain properties or the whole thing. Watch. That would be a killer. In the meantime, this is all so unnecessary. A political stunt. Ron should work on the squatter mess. Now that's a reference to apparently some squatter issues going on in the state. Who looks stupid now? You do, Donald Trump. You look like a moron because you don't know what you're talking about in the state of Florida. And furthermore, you're right, Disney might pull out, except for it's the only thing that's really making Disney as a corporation any sort of money at all. ESPN is hemorrhaging their money. Streaming services, hemorrhaging money. Pay $5,000 a day to go to the Star Wars camp, right, at Disney World? Or is it Disneyland? Disneyland is in California, Disney World in Florida. That's the only thing that's really making them money, and by God, people, you are dumb for paying that kind of money to do what? Cosplay for a day or two? Pay 10 grand to do? Wow, folks. Wow. All for a company that pretty much hates your family, your values, all of that. I'm not saying. I'm just saying. So, good news for Ron DeSantis is that, yeah, guess what? You do have the right to say, no, you don't have your own government anymore. You're under our governmental control going forward, and that means our regulations, our laws. You do not get to supersede us anymore. Deal revoked. It's just that simple. Now, all of that being said, it's time for us to begin our study on the Federalist Papers. And first and foremost, before we get into the actual text of the Federalist Papers, we're going to start with this. This is important to understand because this one lays the groundwork, Federalist number one, for the other 84 essays that are to come. It was published October 27th of 1787. So right around a month after, just a little bit after, like maybe 40 days or so in total, after the passage of the Constitution by the Constitutional Convention. Okay, so now we're in the process of attempting to look to the states to ratify this Constitution or not. But this was an argument for ratification of the Constitution for an audience of the people of New York. Yes, some other states and whatever have you in the mix, if you wanted to take this and run with it, but mainly the argument for the people of New York as to whether or not they were going to ratify this vis-a-vis popular vote. That is the key here, okay? Written for New Yorkers, by New Yorkers, about the ratification of that new system of government. Some would say that's more centralization, or at least a centralized top-down, bottom-up, whatever you want to call it. I think you call it bottom-up, federal government, but whatever have you. So, that is the context in which this is written, okay? This was written not by signing their name to it, right? They did it anonymously to allow for the arguments themselves to stand by themselves. But let's go ahead and take a look at the actual text of said document, right? Federalist number one. It begins like this. After an unequivocal experience of the inefficiency of the subsisting federal government, mainly the Articles of Confederation, that's me saying that, you are called upon to deliberate on a new constitution for the United States of America. The subject speaks of its own importance, comprehending in its consequences nothing less than the existence of the Union, the safety and welfare of the parts of which it is composed, the fate of an empire in many respects, the most interesting in the world. It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country, by their conduct and example, to decide the important question, whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. Now, I'm going to stop right there for those of you who are listening and not watching, because you don't know that I've flipped back to myself, but I wanted to stop there. Because I think it's important for us to understand what Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist Number 1, is talking about here. The keys here, right? Reflection and choice versus accident and force. What is Hamilton trying to say here? Well, he's saying that we, meaning the United States of America, is a unique country with a unique opportunity. One in which we have the right and obligation to choose, as people, our form of government and not have it chosen for us by some despot or whomever can wield the most military might and then enforce their ideas of government down the throats of the rest of us. And he's not wrong. That's unique. Most of history is the second version. And that includes other revolutions, by the way, because the French Revolution is going on at the same time as this is happening on the world scale. So we have to take a look at that. We have to be able to understand it from that perspective. There's a choice being put in front of us. Grab that choice and hold to it tightly. But he continues on. In this first part of the Federalist Paper, number one, he continues on saying, if there be any truth in the remark, the crisis at which we are arrived may with propriety be regarded as the era in which that decision is to be made, and a wrong election of the part we shall act may, in this view, deserve to be considered as the general misfortune of mankind. This idea will add the inducements of philanthropy to those of patriotism, to heighten the solicitude which all considerate and good men must feel for the event. Again, the event is ratifying the Constitution. Happy will it be if our choice should be directed by a judicious estimate of our true interest, unperplexed and unbiased by considerations not connected with the public good. And this, again, is making the argument that we must strip away our own individual wants, needs, desires. Take a look at the public good. Take a look at the concept of, can we be a sustainable society, or do we dissolve and just become confederacies amongst ourselves? And it's now 13 confederacies. Can you defend that? Can you do anything with it, right? That's what he's setting up here. But this is a thing more ardently to be wished than seriously to be expected. Meaning he's saying there's no way to what? Separate your interests, your biases from a discernment of the truth, if you will. He continues to say, the plan offered to our deliberations affects too many particular interests, innovates upon too many local institutions, not to involve in its discussion a variety of objects foreign to its merits and of views, passions, and prejudices little favorable to the discovery of truth. Let's continue on, folks, because it is a good time to go to the second paragraph, where Hamilton says, among the most formidable of the obstacles which the new Constitution will have to encounter may readily be distinguished the obvious interest of a certain class of men in every state to resist all changes which may be hazard a diminution of the power, emolument, and consequence of the offices they hold under the state establishments, and the perverted ambition of another class of men who will either hope to aggrandize themselves by the confusions of their country, or will flatter themselves with fairer prospects of elevation from the subdivision of the empire into several partial confederacies that from its union under one government. So, in this second paragraph, what is he saying? Well, this is all about the recognition of the different and divergent power grabs that are at play here, and reasons that others may or may not want to support this constitution. Maybe it doesn't benefit them financially, or their power, because they would, if the states were to keep the Confederacy going, would have more power than less power. Same for those who support the Constitution, by the way. Not all motivations here are pure, and that's what he is getting at. But he does note that those truths do not make an argument good or bad on its face as well here. So let's get into part three. He continues saying that it is not, however, my design to dwell upon observations of this nature. I am well aware that it would be disingenuous to resolve indiscriminately the opposition of any set of men, in parentheses here, merely because their situations might subject them to suspicion, into interested or ambitious views. Candor will oblige us to admit that even such men may be actuated by upright intentions, and it cannot be doubted that much of the opposition which has made its appearance or may hereafter make its appearance will spring from sources, blameless at least, if not respectable, the honest errors of minds led astray by preconceived jealousies and fears. So numerous indeed and so powerful are the causes which serve to give a false bias to the judgment that we upon many occasions see wise and good men on the wrong as well as on the right side of questions of the first magnitude to society. All right, I want to stop there because that's exactly what Hamilton is talking about here. He believes the ratification of this Constitution to be the biggest question of whether or not we succeed, and by we mean the United States of America, succeeds going forward. But let us continue on here in the third paragraph, okay? He continues saying that this circumstance, if duly attended to, would furnish a lesson of moderation to those who are ever so much persuaded of their being in the right in any controversy. Any further reason for caution in this respect might be drawn from the reflection that we are not always sure that those who advocate the truth are influenced by purer principles than their antagonists. Ambition, avarice, Personal animosity, party opposition, and many other motives not more laudable than these are apt to operate as well upon those who support as those who oppose the right side of a question. Were there not even these inducements to moderation, nothing could be more ill-judged than that intolerant spirit which has, at all times, characterized political parties. For in politics, as in religion, it is equally absurd to aim at making proselytes by fire and sword. Heresies in either can rarely be cured by persecution. So, basically, in this, Hamilton is speaking to the fact that neither side of the debate should have some sort of absolute moral high ground here. Again, I go back to this. Those that advocate for the truth are influenced by pure intentions. He's not saying that that's the case. What he's saying is that you can't assume that those that advocate for truth or the truth are pure in intentions. Everybody has an angle. Everybody has a bias. Everybody has something that they could obtain. But he's also in this, as we take a look at this again, talking about a warning to America, saying that you have to deliberate. And he says here, and a further reason for caution in this respect might be drawn from the reflection that we are not always sure that those who advocate the truth are influenced by purer principles than their antagonists, right? Even in that, he's saying two different things. He is saying deliberative, slow processes deliver us well-thought-out, well-reasoned opportunities, and that we should take the time to think, to have the arguments, thus the next set of essays coming your way, right? This is what he's setting up, that we must deliberate. We must be deliberative instead of what? Impulsive. So finally, well, not finally, because we got two more parts to this to go, but in Federalist number 4, he continues, and yet, however, just these sentiments will be allowed to be. We have already sufficient indications that it will happen in this, as in all former cases of great national discussion. A torrent of angry and malignant passions will be let loose. To judge from the conduct of the opposite parties, we shall be led to conclude that they will mutually hope to invite the justness of their opinions and to increase the number of their converts by the loudness of their declamations, and the bitterness of their invectives. An enlightened zeal for the energy and efficiency of government will be stigmatized as the offspring of a temper fond of despotic power and hostile to the principles of liberty. An over-scrupulous jealousy of danger to the rights of the people, which is more commonly the fault of the head than of the heart, will be represented as mere pretense and artifice, the stale bait for popularity at the expense of the public good. It will be forgotten, on the one hand, that jealousy is the usual concoctment of love, and that the noble enthusiasm of liberty is apt to be infected with a spirit of narrow and illiberal distrust. On the other hand, it will be equally forgotten that the vigor of government is essential to the security of liberty, that in the contemplation of a sound and well-informed judgment, their interests can never be separated, and that a dangerous ambition more often lurks behind the species mask of zeal for the rights of the people than under the forbidden appearance of the zeal for the firmness and efficiency of government. History will teach us that the former has been found a much more certain road to the introduction of despotism than the latter, and that those men who have overturned the liberties of republics, the greatest number have begun their career by paying an obsequious court to the people, commencing demagogues and ending tyrants. This is the warning that Alexander Hamilton is giving here. In other words, what is popular is not always right, and what is right is not always popular, right? He also warns that in non-centralized republican governments, despotism is often the result, not liberty. It turns out that people love to consolidate power, and it's usually despotic in nature if left to their own devices. And we can talk about this from the concept of Gaetano Musca, right? And his idea of political formulas, the stories that are told that we either agree to or don't agree to. And when we talk about despotism, why is it bad? Obviously, it's bad because it is controlling of other human beings, but it's also bad because only one side of the equation agrees to the story, agrees to the formula, if you will. Not both ruler and ruled, or those giving the power to the rulers, right? That's why this idea of the expert class and managerial political society that we exist in today is so dangerous, because we are seeing the consolidation of power within the few. And the many have no recourse. We're not involved in the story they want to tell. That's a problem for legitimacy of government. All right, so then the final part of Federalist number one is this. It may perhaps be thought superfluous to offer arguments to prove the utility of the Union, a point no doubt deeply engraved on the hearts of the great body of the people in every state, and one which it may be imagined has no adversaries. But the fact is that we already hear it whispered in the private circles of those who oppose the new Constitution, that the 13 states are of too great extent for any general system, and that we must of necessity resort to separate confederacies of distinct portions of the whole. This doctrine will, in all probability, be gradually propagated till it has votaries enough to countenance an open avowal of it. For nothing can be more evident to those who are able to take an enlarged view of the subject than the alternative of an adoption of the new Constitution or a dismemberment of the Union. It will therefore be of use to begin by examining the advantages of that Union, the certain evils, and the probable dangers to which every state will be exposed from its dissolution. This shall accordingly constitute the subject of my next address. All right, so in this final part of Federalist number one, we are seeing Hamilton do what? Acknowledging the point of some foes of the Constitution that, well, the states of the Union are, what, too large in landmass, some of them really large economic engines like Virginia, New York, Pennsylvania, right, Massachusetts, right, all of that. That they're too large, whether you want to talk about them from a landmass or an economic. I've seen it both ways when you study these. But either way, it's too large, then could be effective for a more centralized and strong federal government. In other words, because the country was already huge in land and economic wealth, doing anything to bring them together simply won't work. Centralizing government in a more powerful way, not just about liberty, but about the state's freedom, also about the inability to execute, right? That's going to be the argument that Federalist number two and subsequent ones talk about. But so often, and I'm going to wrap a bow up on today's program with this, so often we hear people advocating for states' rights, right? Or advocating for less centralized government or less government, quoting the Federalist Papers. But that's not what Alexander Hamilton's argument was in number one and isn't going to be going forward. He believes in actual, strong, federalized, central power through the Constitution government. Now, notice we're not talking about the Bill of Rights. Notice that that doesn't come up one bit because it's after the Constitution. This is just the actual mechanism of government. And remember, they used we the people at the very front of the Constitution because they knew they needed the people to help write that story. So when you're talking about limited government, when you're making the arguments of Texas versus the feds and everything in between, using the Federalist Papers, ask yourself a simple question. Were these people actually even arguing for decentralized government? No, they were actually arguing for more centralizing of the government. That's literally what they were saying. But within the framework of the Constitution, okay, within the framework of the Constitution, meaning we're going to have a common monetary system, which was part of the problem of the Articles of Confederation. We are going to have a common military. We're going to have some commonalities amongst the 13 states while still allowing states to have their semi-autonomous setup, right? But I want you to think about this. This is an argument for the Constitution, which is an argument in 1787 for more centralized government. Still limited government. Don't get me wrong on that. Do not get me wrong on that. I'm not saying it's, you know, full-on socialism. That's not what they're arguing for. What they're saying is that there has to be some sort of centralized system in place, because completely decentralized systems often lead to despotism. And I can make an argument that when we talk about immigration in the 1800s, that we were seeing despotism, that our government was despotic in nature. And we'll talk about that later. But I want you to wrap your mind around they're advocating for, in the Federalist Papers, ratification of more centralized government than the loose Articles of Confederation. Can you be for some centralized government and yet be pro-liberty? Let's find out tomorrow and the next 84 days as we talk about the Federalist Papers. So, with that, please be smart, be safe, be kind, make sure you eat all of your meals today, and as always, Matthew 5:47.